Good afternoon or good evening, and welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio, the podcast where we talk with writers about their lives, their craft, their business, and their latest work. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and our podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks. Bookmarks is a literary nonprofit whose programs include the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas. This episode of the podcast is taped in front of a live audience at Bookmarks' new community gathering space and nonprofit independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. My guest today is Holly Goddard-Jones. Holly's first novel, The Next Time You See Me, followed an acclaimed book of short stories. Her debut novel received praise from Gillian Flynn, Kate Atkinson, and The New York Times. Her latest novel is The Salt Line, which Publishers Weekly called social commentary and intense thrills rolled into one seamless story. Holly, welcome to Inside the Writer's Studio.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to talk about possibly some heavy-duty issues tonight, because I think your book brings up some really interesting things to discuss. But I don't want our audience to get the idea that this is a difficult book to read. It's an absolute page-turner. I think you're really going to enjoy it, and I think Holly does a great job of integrating interesting issues to think about into a great adventure story.
Thank you.
So there's a lot of things for us to talk about, but for those in the audience who have not read your book yet, can you just tell us a little bit about what The Salt Line is about?
So The Salt Line is a dystopian novel that is set in a version of North Carolina. It begins in around this area, and then the characters move west toward what is now the Smoky Mountains. It is a world that, in some not-so-distant future point, has been pretty radically changed by a new kind of tick that has a pretty nasty tick-borne disease that it carries. And so borders within the United States have been redrawn, and people live within these protected zones very differently depending on what zone they're in. And these areas between zones, like the Appalachian Mountains, are ungoverned, not a lot of people there. It's not even clear how many people live there. And they're used mostly for like cattle factory operations, logging. There's a lot of industry that happens between zones, but not people actually living their lives there. So the book begins with a group of very wealthy people who are paying through the nose to go on what is being billed as an adventure excursion. So they are traveling west of the quarantined line, the Salt Line, to spend 3 weeks hiking the trails, fishing the brooks, looking at birds take wing and having a natural experience. And so what happens when they go on this trip is that they encounter things that they did not realize that they would encounter.
And that's putting it mildly.
Yeah. So the dangers beyond the Salt Line are not just ticks, is what they find
right,
out.
Right. Would you read us an excerpt from the book?
Yeah. So this is from the first chapter. It's pretty early in the book. We're getting some backstory. The novel begins right in the middle of things with characters getting introduced to what their adventure is going to be by this guy, Andy, who is a kind of colorful character and their guide. And what I'm reading from now is where the chapter breaks momentarily to get into some backstory for the character Edie. So Edie is a young woman in her mid-20s. She's probably the only person on this trip who is poor. And the reason that she is on the trip is because she's dating a wealthy pop singer named Jesse Haggard. And so she is struggling with her identity as his girlfriend. Is she his girlfriend? Is she his equal? Is she his groupie? How do people perceive her? And of course, her experiences in life are very different from those of the very wealthy people who are on this trip beside her. So this is getting into a little bit of what her life was like before she went on this trip. The math had been of the humiliating sort that you saw on web shows like Out of Wedlock. 2 weeks late, three different men, including Jesse, during what Edie had been able to calculate must have been her fertile window. You had to be careful when you talked to about these things. Edie had heard the stories. The pierced, tattooed broad who worked at your side for 4 years and never hesitated to slam the president when the news crawl by the Pabst clock churned out some new story about him. She might be the first one to report you to public safety and morals if you so much as made a little insinuation, floated a teensy hypothetical. In high school, Edie had known a girl whose parents sold both family cars to take a sudden vacation to Midwest Zone, though no one ever vacationed in Midwest Zone. There were the girls you saw on the news, dumped at emergency room bays, or worse, left in alleyways, woke up handcuffed to their hospital beds. You were supposed to be able to find herbal abortion recipes on the dark web, but Edie had no idea how you even got on the dark web, and that was the sort of question you couldn't go around asking either. Not if you liked your freedom. She supposed she could pin it on Jesse, threaten to make a stink if he didn't claim it, or at least give her money enough to go away. There was a good chance it was his anyway. But she liked him. He was sweet. And Edie wasn't built that way. She didn't want to be the kind of person who could treat people like that. A while ago, she'd worked with a woman, a PU, pregnant and unwed, who found a sponsorship through Life Force and actually made a tidy profit once the baby was born. This seemed to Edie like the best option. She had no money to raise a child. She had no desire to raise a child. And she wasn't going to be able to bartend once she was showing. Stefano couldn't legally fire her, and Edie thought he was a decent enough guy not to try, but he'd have the law on his side if he wanted to move her to the kitchen or something, and those jobs paid for shit. She supposed that another sort of person, another sort of woman, would see the pregnancy as a blessing, as a reincarnation of her mother's spirit. Edie's mother would have thought this way. Her mother had been religious. Her church's women's group sent casseroles to Edie's apartment throughout the hospitalization and did prayer circles over her mother's writhing body a couple of times a week. Her mother had always told Edie that she was blessed she could raise her daughter in a place that was not just safe but moral. Atlantic Zone was safe because it was moral, and this had been Edie's father's gift to them, bought with his death, his noble, tragic sacrifice. Edie had never believed in any of this, or most of it, but she loved and respected her mother, and she hadn't fought with her, not often. But no, Edie was more inclined to see the pregnancy like she'd seen her mother's cancer, an invasion, unwelcome, to be survived and not embraced. It helped her a little to think of the pregnancy as a job, a hard job, like her father's six-month tours out of zone. You could do anything for 9 months, for money. Her pregnancy would be contract work, a deployment. She told herself this again and again. She stopped answering when Jesse messaged her. This hurt, but it was easier, cleaner than putting herself through his awkward reaction, the pain and humiliation of his rejection of her. She marked days on her calendar, careful to keep even these vague notations on print copies, never doing a search for Life Force or Caring Connection or The Greatest Love online. When she started showing, no sooner, she would walk into one of the clinics and start the process, let them tag and process and herd her, police what she ate and drank, her medications, the music she listened to, the web shows she watched. She would undergo the genetic screenings, the rigorous family history surveys. She had her looks going for her, but her mixed-race heritage might be a liability, as well as her mother's breast cancer, though a wealthy enough family could pay to have a gene like that shut off.
That's a good example in several places in that reading, which I loved, of what I wanted to ask you next, which is you've created this future world where there are some things that we recognize. There's the dark web is a thing, the internet is a thing, people have tablets, but there's a lot of things that we don't recognize. How do you drop readers right into the middle of this. How do you decide how much we need to know about how we got from where we are now to this world that you've created, what you leave in and what you leave out?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it was a big part of what I struggled with when I decided I was actually going to attempt to write the book. And what I decided was that I didn't think the reader had to know a whole lot. And I didn't want to go into some lengthy explanation of, and this year this thing happened, and then 10 years later, that's when the government redrew the boundaries, and then 20 years after that is when, people were mown down in the streets by armies. And so I didn't want to get into a lot of specifics about how it went from the way that we live now to the way that they live. And one thing that I figured out during the writing was that, and I'm not you know, a science fiction writer. That's not my background. So this is all new territory for me. But for me, writing it as close to how we live now with just little tweaks seemed like the scariest thing I could possibly do. So that ended up being my approach.
I think the fact that there are elements in there that we recognize from our daily lives today makes it much scarier, because if it was all completely different and futuristic, it would be easier for us to separate ourselves from that and say, oh, well, that's just her imagination. So there are some things that are scarily relevant in this book. In particular, as you mentioned before, there is essentially a border wall around the zone that, presumably around all the zones, but certainly around the zone that we're in. And there's all other elements in the book that they might say in Law and Order parlance were ripped from the headlines. Was there a point when you were writing this book when you realized that was going to be the case? Was that something you did intentionally, or were you halfway through and suddenly people were talking about building a wall?
So I finished the rough draft of this novel in December, I think it was December 31st, actually, of 2015. So at that point, I can't remember if Trump had made his wall comments by then or not, but the wall existed in the book pretty early on. I mean, I started the book in, I think it was 2012. So there was a version of that border from the very beginning. And I think what you see here is a combination of there being these elements in the book. So the wall, early on I was thinking about the border between Mexico and the United States and how drugs are moved across that border. So I was in France in early 2014, and I remember I was reading this book called Narco, which is about heroin production in Mexico and the symbiotic relationship between Mexico and the United States. And so I was reading that as research for the book. So I had all of that on my mind as I was working on the draft. So then things started happening in the news. And as I was finishing the draft of the book, I think we were getting the first, you know, indications that this Trump candidacy was scarily viable. And when I was doing revisions, the pretty heaviest set of revisions to the book, that was right around the time that he got the Republican nomination. So at that point, I think all of these things that had been sort of coincidentally present in the book, I went and revisited through the lens of what I was seeing and what was happening. So this character in the book, David Perrone, there's a character who is a crime boss, basically. He is head of the organized crime clan for this zone. And in the original draft, he was pretty much just that. And as I revised and I was experiencing the election of 2016, I started to think about him as a character who might have political aspirations, right, and what would that mean. So that's one of the ways I think that the commentary became a little more pointed.
I think it's something maybe that readers don't think about a lot, that the span of time that it takes to write a novel or even to move from a first draft to a published book is a big enough span of time that things that happen out in the world can affect the way that we edit a particular book, even a work of fiction.
Yeah.
So the characters get outside the wall, and they begin to encounter other things from the past, from our present, that we might recognize as cultural artifacts. One in particular that I just think is hilariously wonderful, which is they come across the remnants, the well-preserved remnants of a Cracker Barrel restaurant and country store. And you can imagine what that might seem like to someone who has no previous experience with the Cracker Barrel. But how did you approach the task of depicting a world that is sort of decayed and falling apart, and yet finding these points of connection that have some meaning for the people who are experiencing that world?
Well, I mean, to use the Cracker Barrel as an example, I was telling somebody recently that I have kind of a love-hate relationship with Cracker Barrel. I've eaten at a lot of Cracker Barrels. Part of the reason that the book is set where it is because my family lives in Kentucky, my husband's family. We do a lot of commuting between Greensboro and our small town in Kentucky. And so I-40 is, this route that we have spent, you know, probably weeks of our lives traveling. And part of the I-40 experience is the Appalachian Mountains, and part of it is Cracker Barrel. So I like the food, and I think the food is consistent and fine. And so we'll go there because we know what we're getting. Then you have to spend, I'm sure everyone here has been in a Cracker Barrel, you have to spend 20 minutes or so waiting in that store in the front. And it's this distillation of a certain kind of American culture. Some of it, I think, I feel kind of sweetly protective of, and some of it, I'm sure, I'm kind of scornful of. And it really represents a mix of the things that I love and don't love about where I'm from. And so I was thinking about all of that as I tried to come up with something that these characters would encounter that would encapsulate what our world now is, and especially in the South. And so that's how I thought of that as a location. And they are making a journey via interstate into the mountains as well. And so it seemed necessary that Cracker Barrel be one of their stops. Yeah.
So you create this world and you create characters. And one of the things I like about this novel is, in my mind, there wasn't a single protagonist. There's this group of characters, and you spend time with each of them. You have multiple points of view, and each one of them has their good points and their bad points. And I found that refreshing, that I wasn't just following one person. But what came first for you, the world or the characters? And then how did you create the other one to work within the one that came first?
In Sketch, the world came first. I was trying to retrace my steps and how this book even came to be. And one of the things that I've said before about it is that I got pregnant shortly after I started writing it for the first time. And I've had two kids in the span of the 4 years of the writing process. And so I have, you know, part of my brain erased, I think, is what's happened. I can't even account for how I wrote the book. But what I do remember early on is that I'd had some tick encounters. I'd had an unfortunate incident with a chigger's nest. I had sat in a chigger's nest, which I don't recommend doing. Uh-huh. So I had those encounters with insects, and then I had read a horror novel called The Ruins, which involves these creeping vines that kill a group of college students who are on vacation in South America. And I was thinking about how that author, Scott Smith, had pulled off this really small-scale monster, and I was really impressed by how he had done that. So I thought I would try to do something similar, and I didn't think that this was going to be a book. I thought it was going to be kind of a fun short story that I would, you know, spend maybe a few weeks on it, 30 pages of my life on it. And I started writing the story, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I think one thing that happened is I started to get to know the characters. And so my lens out of the gate for this experience of traveling as part of this group was I wanted a person who is not one of these people. And so that's how I got to know Edie, developed her character. So the premise came first, but it was really the premise wedded to Edie and then these other characters, Marta and Wes, that I think made this become a novel and not just a story.
I think that you talk about the small scale monster, the tick is just brilliant, because I doubt there's anybody in this room who's ever encountered a zombie or a vampire or a werewolf, but we probably all encountered a tick. And it's just, every time I mention that to somebody, I've just read this book where the monster is just a tick. They're like, oh, it's so creepy. So we had an interesting book club discussion here at Bookmarks earlier this week. And one of the things we talked about is the inherent dishonesty of what we do as novelists, that we're trying to convince you that stories and characters are real when we, in fact, just made them up. And it sort of brings up this question of how do we tread the line of making everything seem real and not push it too far? How far is too far? Which I think, especially with a book like yours, that must be something that's in your mind. How do you decide how far you can go and make it real within the world you've created, and how far is a step too far?
As pertains to ticks, for instance?
Well, just as it pertains to the whole world that you're creating and the story within it.
I don't know if I'm answering the question in the way that you are posing it, but I'll say that I'm going to back into, I think, an answer to your question. So I had my second child in November of last year, and it was 2 weeks after the election. And it was, I mean, you know, I'm going to have to just be frank here. It was devastating to me. And it was a pretty ripe setup for postpartum depression. And so I spent, you know, the 6 months, my daughter's now 10 months old. I spent about 6 months of the beginning of her life really just struggling to get up and comb my hair, you know, and take care of her and take care of my son. And so it was a difficult time. And as I was struggling through that, part of me was wondering how I was ever going to be able to do what I'm doing in this moment, sit in a room and account for this book, because I was afraid of what I had written. How am I going to talk about like this possible devastating future when all I can think about is my two children and what their futures might be like? And you know, so I mean, I remember early in that process, as you know, the publicist for the publisher was you know, starting to send me the questions that they would put into the marketing package and all of that. She sent me an article saying, "Oh, have you seen this? It's about ticks and how tick-borne illnesses are on the rise." I was like, "I can't even read this. I don't want to know this. I mean, I wrote this book about ticks and disease, but I don't want you to send me this article. I don't want to know what it says." Yeah. And so I guess it's kind of funny in a way. I mean, the process has been reversed for me. I wrote the book, and now I'm you know, or at least in the immediate wake of my baby being born, I was afraid of what I had written. So I don't know what's too far in engaging these real issues. You have to be, I think, willing to write about the world you're in and the fates that you're afraid of. You have to have the courage it takes to put those issues in front of people. You have to also be hopeful, and I think the book ultimately is, mm-hmm. and that's what I cling to. If you're asking about the sort of rip from the headlines thing, like, is it too far to take a character like David Perrone and give him some Trumpian qualities? I think the risk there is, I mean, you know, alienating some readers, and I think maybe also the risk is that you're dating your book, or, you know, you're making it seem too particular to a certain historic moment. And I think with this, my guide was taking the things that were already present in the book and then just letting my experiences hone them into something.
And I don't think it feels dated. I mean, although there are certainly those connections to be made, it's a book that would stand on its own as a great read without those connections.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I want to talk about some things that your characters say, because every now and then one of Holly's characters says something that makes me stop in my tracks and go, I have to write this down. And this is one of them. A character says, there's this assumption that most people, if you strip society and its laws away, are capable of evil. Now, that is the conceit, I think, of so much of futurist literature, film, television, that when society breaks down, it's going to bring out the worst in us. Why do we assume, why do we take what I call the anti-Anne Frank stance? Why do we assume that when the worst comes to worst, it's going to bring out the worst in human nature and not the best? Is it just because it makes a better story?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things I was struggling with as I wrote the book. When I realized I was writing a dystopian novel, I think there were a lot of points where, well, I'll give you a specific example. I got to a point where I wondered if this character, Edie, should be sexually assaulted by one of her captors. And I started to kind of back up and question why I was even considering that possibility. And I realized that it is such a trope of dystopian and post-apocalyptic fiction, as I've seen it on television and read it in books, that it's almost obligatory that at some point a female character is going to be assaulted by a terrible male character. And so when I realized that, I really wanted to resist it. And so that's not in this book. I mean, for good or ill, it's not something that happens. I think I've thought a lot about this as I struggled with the things that I mentioned struggling with. I do think these things perpetuate themselves. So I think that times now do feel scary, and I'm not going to try to minimize that. But I think that social media and popular culture present a certain picture of what the next thing might be like, and then everything kind of doubles down on what came before. And so it seems like, okay, the smart assumption is this is the direction everything is going. I think that's some component of
what you're talking about. There's nothing new about post-apocalyptic literature showing that a breakdown in society is going to lead to people being bad. I think about, the very first Mad Max movie and things like that. Here's another great quote, and this one I think we can delve into maybe even deeper. So the zoners, these are the people who live on what we might call the safe side of the wall, where there is a fairly structured society, and we're safe from the ticks and their diseases. And this is somebody who does not live in the zone speaking. And the character says, "I don't hold it against them, the zoners, how they live. There's a gift in not getting. You're never asked to give it up. You don't have to decide if you're going to live with your hypocrisy or make a sacrifice that no one else around you is willing to make, just as a symbol." Now, to me, that really resounded in the light of discussions about white privilege and economic divides. Can you talk a little bit about what you meant by the gift of not getting?
Well, and I'm coming from a context that is still pretty privileged, so I'll preface what I'm saying with that. But I was thinking, on a personal level, I was thinking about, I grew up working class. My dad's a factory worker. My mom didn't work. And so I think, I always had everything I needed, but I didn't have most of what I wanted. Mm-hmm. And I think, in a lot of ways, it was a really good way to grow up. Again, I'm comparing my situation. I'm not saying my situation is comparable to someone raised in poverty. I think that's a different issue altogether. So one of the struggles that I faced as a parent is I have more means to give my kids a certain kind of life. How much is too much?
Right.
And I think that these are issues that could extend to how we as Americans perceive our privilege as compared to everywhere else in the world. So a struggle that I have as an American in this day and age is, even with all my ideals, even with everything I believe, I still live within a system that means that I get to have a substantial amount of luxury. And to give that up would be to take a kind of what feels like a futile symbolic stand.
Right.
And so it's hard to know what the right thing to do is.
So there are among some of your characters, and again, one of the things I love about the character, to go back just a minute, you were talking about how people are going to act. Does it bring out the best in them or the worst in them? That you have characters who you will see humanity at their very best in this character, and then suddenly you will see them do something pretty horrendous in the space of a couple of pages, which I love. So it sort of keeps you on your toes. But there is, among many of the characters, and for a variety of reasons, varying levels of mistrust of what we assume is the government. Somebody talks about running for president, so we know there's some sort of government there. Now, I can remember a time in my childhood, during the height of the Cold War, when most of literature about mistrust of the government was about mistrust of them in 1984 and books like that. And then came Vietnam and Watergate, and suddenly that mistrust of government was starting to come very close to home. Do you think now that mistrust of the government is the standard rather than trust of the government? And if so, how does that affect literature?
That's a really interesting question. I think that I can't. Maybe two things can be true at once. So just to use myself as an example, I'm someone who I think maybe has put too much trust in the government to some extent. For instance, to solve environmental issues, I've trusted that, you know, if things are bad, the government is, you know, eventually going to, you know, read the science and do what's necessary to perpetuate the human race, right? And I think that was probably, it's maybe problematic for us collectively to just assume, okay, I'm not going to change the way I live on a day-to-day basis until the government tells me that this is what I need to do. I'm not going to consider my power options. I'm not going to reduce how much I travel. I'm not going to question what my investment strategies should be. The government will tell me when I can do that. So I think there's that on the one hand. There's a lot of trust in the government to be able to figure out problems. On the other, I think what you experience through social media, probably to some extent on both sides of the aisle, is the sense that the government is never going to do enough, and that the people that we've put into office do not have our best interests at heart. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why people feel like that. Probably some of it, though, is because everything they do is more visible now. And when it was mysterious, you could just hope that they were doing their job and doing the best that they could do.
So you set your book in Western North Carolina, as mm-hmm. you said before, on the I-40 corridor. It's an area that I'm sure most of us in this room and many of our listeners are familiar with. You and I both live in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. We've both written books that are at least partly set in North Carolina. But I'm not sure that I certainly wouldn't consider The Bookman's Tale Southern literature in the traditional sense. And I'm not sure I'd consider The Salt Line Southern literature in traditional sense. What's the difference between being a writer who lives in the South and being a Southern writer?
Mm-hmm. So my first two books, I think, were really branded as Southern fiction. And some of this, I think, is marketing. You know, the publisher is always looking for some kind of angle from which they can sell the book to a certain audience. And so if they can call it Southern literature, then there is an audience that's going to, you know, probably want to buy that. But I think that the first two books, too, were pretty directly concerned with what is the South? What does it mean to live in the South? How does the history of being a Southerner affect the present and what the South means today? I was writing in my novel about, well, I mean, really both the story collection and the novel about small town life in a way that I think was pretty imbued with a certain kind of Southern small town experience. And this book, you know, the future depicted is one that I think is not so particular to region. At the same time, I would say that the South is a pretty good microcosm for the kinds of issues that this book is exploring in terms of the impact of environmental disaster, racial issues, class inequality, border crossing. So all of those things, I think, do connect with Southern literature, but it's presented in this speculative context that I think feels more general.
So before I move on to my next question, which is more about you and less about your book, I want to go back to what I said at the beginning, because we've been talking about all of these things, class inequality. It's a really good read. It's a good futuristic novel it's one of those things, I have this trouble talking about my own books. There are big left and right turns in the middle of the book that you don't see coming, and I can't tell you about them, and Holly can't tell you about them, because it will ruin your enjoyment of the book. But there were several places where I went, oh my, I really need to find out what happens in the next chapter. So there's another point of convergence that you and I have, and that is that we have both gone through the dreaded or maybe not dreaded MFA program and gotten our MFAs in creative writing, and you teach creative writing at the university level. Mm-hmm. And this will seem like a loaded question, but to what extent can you really teach writing?
I've thought a lot about what I think writing workshops do and what's my purpose in teaching creative writing. And so just to take on the question of can you teach writing, I think you can't teach someone to be talented if they lack talent. Right. But I teach writing every day, and I help students become better writers. I think you can teach technique. You can teach people how to read analytically so that they are reading novels and stories and figuring out how they're put together and what point of view is and what's the structure, what's the text and subtext divide. There are lots of concrete ways that I take students through a process in a writing class. And so I think absolutely you can teach that. What I think I've been struggling with in the last several years is, okay, I can do it. Is it enough? Am I putting good into the world by teaching people how to write? I can make somebody a better writer. That doesn't mean that they're going to become a writer who publishes a book. And even if they do become a writer who publishes a book, is that book a kind of good that's in the world? Are my own books a kind of good that's in the world? And the thing that I keep circling back to is that the writing workshop consistently in my experience is a space where students get practice empathizing. Yeah. And I think that that is more important than ever. And so that's what I see myself doing, not only teaching technique, but giving students a space to imagine the experiences of other human beings in a concrete way.
I think it's so important when we teach writing and when we teach literature to have that in mind. We know, I mean, if you go to a medical school, there's a pretty good chance you're going to have a job that, pays your bills in the medical field at some point down the line. But if you go to an MFA program, there's no guarantee you're ever going to be a writer who pays your bills doing the writing. But there are other things you can gain out of it. Mm-hmm. And empathy and being able to enrich your lives. I think just being able to read a book and sit down and talk about it. That's one of the big things I learned in my MFA program. I go to book clubs and I see some people who are really good at talking about books and other people who can't get beyond I liked it or I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And so to me, that was a really valuable thing. Mm-hmm. What's next? What are you working on now?
So I have a contract for a next book that is connected with this one. It is not exactly a sequel or a prequel. It's set maybe 25 years in time earlier than The Salt Line, and it takes up an entirely new set of characters with maybe some convergence toward the end. What I told my editor it was is I'll say Stand By Me, though I'm thinking of the story that inspired it, The Body, but Stand By Me will probably be a more visible touchstone for people. So it's kind of Stand By Me with an all-female cast. And so 12 and 13-year-old girls who go on a journey together beyond the wall to rescue an older sister who has been trafficked to a destination that's mentioned in The Salt Line called Flat Rock.
Right.
So
I have a friend who lives in Flat Rock. So
oh, really?
We'll see how that goes
I'm
for
sure
him.
It's a lovely place. I haven't actually been to Flat Rock. I did a lot of touring of Flat Rock via Google Maps and the street view. But
It's interesting the kind of research we do when we're writing a book in a place. I'm working on a novel right now that's set in New York City in 1906. And I looked at so many scanned atlases and maps and things from the New York Public Library to try to figure out how that world fit together. Mm-hmm. So we like to end every episode of Inside the Writer's Studio with the same 10 questions. Each of them is a short answer question. This is the rapid fire round, and hopefully they'll give us a little something to think about, both in terms of writing and a little insight into you and your world and the way you go about writing. So here we go. You ready?
Okay, I think so.
What word do you love to work into your own writing?
I love the word reckon, I think
she is a Southern writer.
Well, and I love it because it feels so Southern, but it also feels British, and I think it's a beautiful word and an idea, but I also love to say reckon, so.
What word do you hate to encounter in other people's writing?
So this is an answer that is going to speak to my role as a teacher, but the word I would say is suddenly, because I think if you encounter, I mean, I've used it many times, so I'm being a total hypocrite here, but if you encounter the word suddenly in a story, oftentimes it means that the author has plunked something in without earning it.
Right. Where's your favorite place to write?
I don't really have a consistent writing space anymore. I have an office that is covered up with toys and detritus, and I never go in there. So a lot of times now I write at the dining room table or in coffee shops. So
where could you never write?
My office.
To what rule of grammar do you pay least attention?
I think I like the well-made sentence fragment.
Yep. What was the first book you remember reading?
I have a way I want to answer this, but it's a lie because it's not the first book I remember reading. But I mean, the first book that I remember reading, the way I read books now, is Bridge to Terabithia, and I remember reading it and feeling like I had been subsumed in the story and broken by it. So I feel like I want to choose that one instead of the picture books and things that I sort of vaguely recall reading.
What are you reading right now?
I'm reading a book called The Magpie Murders, and it's from what I can tell so far, I've been trying to avoid jacket copy on things on purpose because I find it gives a lot of the book's pleasures away. But from what I can tell so far, it is a kind of meta mystery story. So there's an editor who is introducing the book in the early pages, and then there's a mystery novel. You even get like the title page and the blurbs, and then the mystery novel begins. And my expectation is that somehow the two stories are going to, you know, intrude on one another. So
what book would you like to have written?
Two books come to mind, and there are lots, these aren't necessarily my favorite books of all time, but these are the books that I think are doing something so similar to what I love and think that I would like to be able to do and possibly could do, when I read them, I remember thinking, I wish, you know, that this had been something that I'd written. So one is Cloud Atlas by David Mitchell, and the other is Annihilation by Jeff Vandermeer. They're very different books. Cloud Atlas is big and bulky and is doing all of this experimentation with different sorts of storytelling and different voices, and Annihilation is slim and concentrated in first person, but they're both so good.
What sort of book would you like to write but probably never will?
So the book that I would like to write, and I hope I'll write, but probably will never write, but I'm not going to give up on this. I want to write a really slim first-person novel. I don't write in first-person a lot. I find it hard to stay in one point of view for the duration of a project, and so I'd love to. So Julian Barnes's The Sense of an Ending, I just love that novel, and I want to write something as compact and powerful as that.
And finally, what would you like to hear a reader tell you?
I think that, I mean, you know, so this isn't a very sophisticated answer, but when somebody has just said with clear sincerity, I loved it, you know, there's really nothing better than that.
Yeah. That's absolutely true. Yeah. This has been Inside the Writer's Studio. I'm your host, Charlie Lovett, and the podcast is sponsored by Bookmarks, a literary nonprofit that runs the largest annual book festival in the Carolinas and operates a new community gathering place and independent bookstore in downtown Winston-Salem, North Carolina. To find out more about Bookmarks and all its programs, visit www.bookmarksnc.org. My guest today has been Holly Goddard-Jones, whose new novel, The Salt Line, is available wherever books are sold, and of course you can get signed copies from Bookmarks. Holly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Join me next time on Inside the Writer's Studio when I'll be talking with Emily Wilson about her new book about Eleanor Roosevelt, The Three Graces of Valkill. Until then, thanks for listening, and may you read with wonder and write with passion.